Welcome to the Total Soccer Show and our first weekend review of 21-22. It was a weekend in which we learned Man City need a man up top. Man United look like the cream of the crop. Barca haven't had a post-Messi drop. Erling Haaland cannot stop. And Jimmy Madranda had a pretty good pop from a corner. Joining me today is a man who's as comforting and reassuring as a Christian Pulisic opening day goal, Taylor Rockwell.
Wow, that's like the nicest thing I think you've ever said to me on this show. Hi, Ryan. Thanks for that.
Now you're making me think I've never said anything nice to you, Taylor.
No, you've said nice things. That's just the nicest to compare me to a Christian Pulisic goal and the comfort that that does bring to the American fan base, which was once again very anxious about the future of Christian Pulisic at Chelsea. He scores a goal, so at least that's good.
Yeah, just remember this time last year, Tay-Tay, when Frank Lampard didn't know his name, I don't think. So we've come a long way from that point, certainly.
We have.
A long way indeed. Also here today is a man who can dissect the game with the ease of Liverpool dissecting Norwich City whenever they play them, Graham Ruthven.
Hi, Ryan. How are you? I'll take that as a compliment, given how easily Liverpool did slice open Norwich. I have deja vu with Norwich, with everyone bigging them up before the start of the season. And then the season starts and, maybe they're going to be down there again. That's awkward.
Yeah. Playing lots of open soccer, but have some work to do. It's the same report card that we saw issued the last time they were in the Premier League a little bit. But I think they've got a bit more about them, Graham, certainly. I've got a couple of notes I had from the weekend here. No draws in the opening week of Premier League action, which was fun. And Graham, I don't know if you're watching Match of the Day, but they did a graphic with Jurgen Klopp and Daniel Farke on the same screen. And Klopp doesn't have it. He's not wearing glasses at the moment.
Yeah.
And they look like the same man. And I was really confused as to who was who. It's like this slightly beady German man.
Which thing did you find more off-putting? That, Klopp not wearing the glasses and the face comparison there, or a clean-shaven or relatively clean-shaven Gerard Piqué? Because that also seemed very strange to me. I wasn't really ready for that.
Has anyone spotted Gerard Piqué's Instagram at the moment?
Oh, it's all the same face, right?
It's all selfies of the same expression for about the last month. I'm not kidding. I posted a picture of it on my Twitter today. A man who seemingly before the summer hadn't discovered a selfie camera now believes that is the only camera on his phone. It's quite unnerving.
And you have to like you can see your grid. You know the last things you posted. I occasionally look at mine and think, there's more to my life than just my daughter. I should probably post other things that aren't just a baby. I like that Gerard Piqué has gone the opposite route of, I'm just posting my face with the same unaffected expression. It's very Kristen Stewart of him.
He needs to make the most of it, to be honest. I'm not sure he can afford a phone contract now he's on $4 a week. Might be cut off soon. We never know.
Shakira can pick up the bill. Are they still together? I'm assuming they are.
I believe
so.
They are.
Yeah. Okay, good.
Yeah. She may be getting slightly higher remuneration in the coming months and years than her husband. We shall see about that. And we'll get to Barcelona later on in the show and much more indeed. I wanted to touch on some personal experience here because if there's one thing Total Soccer Show lacks, guys, it's me talking about AFC Wimbledon.
In the appropriate setting, Ryan, in the appropriate setting. That's the difference.
So Friday night with the Premier League, it was very, very exciting. We had Brentford against Arsenal, a brand new London side against a finished one, if you want to call it that. I'm coming out firing already, but it was a pretty good game for Brentford, mainly because it was the first time for them in their new stadium with fans present. And it felt like a very special moment. And you could see how thrilled Thomas Frank was at that stadium. Thomas Frank, the Brentford manager, who, by the way, my brother ran past in Richmond Park on Saturday morning. I thought I had to get some more stuff in. I'm I couldn't resist. But on Saturday, AFC Wimbledon had the same thing, playing at home in a brand new stadium with fans for the first time. And I was lucky enough that my time here in the UK coincided with that. And it's a huge, huge emotional time for Wimbledon fans. It's the first home game in 30 years. Wimbledon moved away from Wimbledon in 1991, went to Selhurst Park and then went to King's Meadow, neither of which are in Wimbledon. It was just an incredibly emotional occasion. I'm mad enough to admit that walking to the stadium, I had a little cry. I saw that it was against Bolton Wanderers, and walking out from the train station, you get this thing in the UK when away fans come to a ground, they'll take over a pub. They'll decide, this is our pub, we'll put our flags outside. And the first one of those I saw, I kind of got the hair stand up in the back of my neck, like, we're back, guys. Fans are in stadiums again. We've got the banter. I can hear northern accents on the streets of London. This is wonderful. This is wonderful, wonderful stuff. So I get into the stadium, and it's perfectly brand new and shiny and wonderful. It's going to be a beautiful sunny day. And I got down to the bar, and I met Andy Brassel, coincidentally. Hey. And we had this, you know that Paul Rudd meme, where it's like, who'd have thought it? Look at us. Not me. That was kind of the feeling we both had, looking like, it's amazing that we're in this brand new stadium that's completely funded by fans, by the way. This was a fan initiative. Wimbledon had the opportunity to take outside investment at one point when it looked like costs were rising, which they did indeed. But we refused to take up majority, concede majority ownership, and created bonds and debentures to basically make it happen. And we did. And it was just incredible. And at the start of the game, there was a minute's applause dedicated to all Wimbledon fans who couldn't make it to see the team come back. Because as I say, it's been 30 years. And that hit me again. I got the feels again because, as I've mentioned on the show before, my dad passed away in 2015. He was the one who indoctrinated my brother and me into Wimbledon and its ways. And I just, all I could think was, if he could be here today, he'd be... I can't even say. It was yeah. It was just an incredible, incredible time. Very, very emotional. And also a very good game. Wimbledon were 3-1 down, and we pulled it back to 3-3. Very nearly got a 4-3 goal as well. And it was just one of those days where I was reminded, this is why we love this sport. I went out for dinner later on with my wife in the evening, and she was just like, oh, you're just obsessed with soccer, aren't you? Why do you love it so much? And I kind of sort of sat back, and it sounds really cliche, but I was like, it's not really about the soccer. For me, it's about what it brings to you. It's about my family. It's about community. I was born into my club and I'm a part of it. I'm literally an owner of my club and a stakeholder in it. And for me, it's my family's legacy. It's how we sort of define ourselves. And I think it's the importance of football for a lot of people has been shown as the fans have come back this weekend and in previous weeks as well. It is a community sport at its heart. It's for everybody. And it's something that brings us together. It's part of the human condition that we need to be together. And for me and for many of our listeners and for many people around the world, soccer is that vehicle. So that was my time at Wimbledon, and it was a lovely Saturday. Thank you for asking.
Ryan, with that, the meme you mentioned of the, like, look at us, look how we got here. Like, was that a shared vibe, like, with you and, sorry, who were Wimbledon playing again?
Bolton. So, yeah, it was interesting because it was a sold-out stadium. It's around 10,000 capacity at the moment. The Bolton fans had behind one of the goals, and they were really loud. And I was thinking, why aren't the Wimbledon fans as loud as them at the moment? And particularly for the first half, it all just felt like we were in a daze. We're all just like, I can't believe this is happening. Yes, we were excited and we were thrilled to be there, but you look around and it was wet eyes everywhere, and people just like, this is incredible that this has happened. So I think I'm going back on Tuesday. We're playing Gillingham on Tuesday, so I'll come back and it'll be louder then.
I think, obviously, that this whole... periods the last 18 months has been dreadful, and if there's a few positives, I think through soccer, one of them is that you mentioned there, Ryan, that soccer isn't actually really about the game that gets played on the pitch, and right. I think there is a greater understanding of that now, and I actually haven't been able to get back to my club yet. Our rules are slightly different in Scotland. I'm hoping that will happen In the next few weeks, but when I do get back to Stirling Albion, you know, there'll be friends there that I haven't seen in nearly 2 years who I sit with when I go and watch them play. And the closest thing I've had to it was actually on Friday night. To what you mentioned there, Ryan, the closest I've had to that was on Friday night with Brentford, a club I have no connection to. I'm quite fond of them. I'd like to see them do well. And those scenes at full time, me and my wife has absolutely zero connection to soccer in any way. She doesn't tend to watch any of the games. We just sat in silence and watched, you know, a full capacity crowd at Brentford sing Hey Jude or Hey Brentford, as they sing, with old guys with tears streaming down their face and Thomas Frank, you know, cheering with young kids in the stand. And it was amazing. And like that, I felt slightly emotional at that. And that's a club that I have no connection to. So I can't imagine what it was like for you, Ryan, going to Wimbledon, not just with COVID, but obviously everything that club has been through as well.
Yeah, yeah. Power of the sport, Graham. The power of the sport. And it is a wonderful thing that we're all sharing a part of.
Now that you all have brought this up and made me emotional, I think we need some sort of TSS preseason tournament where we can get the Richmond Kickers, my local team, Phoenix Rising, who I think would destroy the Richmond Kickers, Joe's team. We get Sterling, we get Wimbledon, maybe we get like Wolves Academy team, and we get them all together, and we just have like a preseason tour or preseason tournament with those five clubs. I think I've stumbled upon something. We need to get that sort of preseason competition going so we can feel the chemistry all the more.
Yeah, better than the Super League.
We'll call it the Florida Cup, Taylor. What do you think? Does that take
I love it. I hate it. I love it.
You know, I love talking about the weekend's action. Why don't we get to it with the box office game of the weekend, certainly in Premier League terms. We had Tottenham taking on Manchester City at Tottenham Hotspur Stadium, as it's known. 60,000 fans in there. And I'll let you know, I was actually offered a ticket for this game. I couldn't make it, unfortunately. But a vaccine was required or proof of a negative test. So the 60,000 fans in there, so they are trying to do it relatively safely as well. I'll tell you who was unsafe, though. Manchester City, they're fourth time visiting this stadium and their fourth loss as well. Graham, what did you make of this one? It was a pretty fun open game, wasn't it? And I think I saw you tweet something along the lines of, this is quite bizarre from Man City. The reasons for which are?
I thought it was a really, really strange performance from Manchester City. The first thing to say is, in the first 15 minutes, I thought they actually looked pretty good and they really should have been ahead. They had a couple good chances through. I think it was Cancelo had a really good chance and Grealish had a really good driving run within 3 minutes that he could have gone clean through and goal if he hadn't been tripped on the edge of the box. So they actually looked quite good early on. Beyond that, I thought City were quite frankly dreadful, honestly. I thought I didn't understand their game plan at all. They attempted 30 crosses in this game. Were they aiming those crosses for 5'9" Ferran Torres, who was playing as the centre forward, or was it 5'8" Riyad Mahrez, who was on the right side, or was it 5'6" Raheem Sterling, who was on the left side, or was this just a ploy by Guardiola to prove how badly he needs Harry Kane in the middle? Who obviously that was the elephant in the room with this game. His spectre loomed large over this fixture, and look, in my opinion, Kane is probably going to leave. I've got no inside information. It's just a hunch. I think he probably will be a City player by the end of the transfer window. And then if this is a breakup, I think Spurs at the moment are winning that breakup because I saw a team that can cope without Harry Kane. Obviously, it'll be slightly different when they have to impose their own game on teams. But there were clear signs of Nuno ball, if I can call it that, in this Spurs performance. I said in the preview that a hallmark of his Wolves team were individual runners from deep, and I think that was something that caused City a lot of problems. And I just felt like City never got to grips with what Spurs were throwing at them, which was a lot of fast three-man counter-attacking through Son, Bergwijn, and Lucas Moura. Yep. And they just left with Grealish on the left side of that midfield three. I think we kind of saw what Guardiola wants from Grealish for the first time, which was a lot of interchange of move with Sterling and one going and then the other falling back and then the other going and the other falling back. But the problem with that was poor Fernandinho, was just left on his own to deal with the Spurs counterattack on his own. Gundogan is, I know he has been a six in the past, but he's now more of an eight, maybe even more than that, more attacking. And he was pushing forward. And I just felt like City kind of forgot that they need to protect at the back, particularly because the fullbacks weren't really pushing into central midfield, which was a feature of last season. Cancelo wasn't really doing that. So I think City, the two games they've played this season, the Community Shield and this one, have more questions about City now that we're into the season than we did before the season started.
And Graham, like the fullbacks not going central was especially baffling as this game went on, because we saw Pep over and over, the camera would cut to him on the sidelines and there were very animated conversations in that bench about what was happening and what needed to change. And the commentators were telling us that he was telling them to step forward more aggressively and get numbers higher up the pitch. And I understand all that. And it's the first game of the Premier League season, second game for City overall. But the lack of sort of numbers in the middle was really odd to me, again, especially as the game went on, because that was clearly what Spurs were trying to do, were keep that kind of front three that you mentioned very narrow, close together, and then you can counterattack through them. And that's where the goal comes from. That's where most of their counterattacks came from, were sort of rapid fire counters through the middle because they had a mismatch. And to some extent, I think they're playing they're basically utilizing what Man City want to do, which is have those kind of attacking fullbacks get involved in the attack. And they're using that to their advantage rather than spreading those wide players wide, obviously, but then hoping to pin those fullbacks back. They basically kept them central and had that overload constantly. And why Pep never had the fullbacks move more central to limit that or put more numbers there to kind of negate the threat of the counter. Instead, he basically had Fernandinho step even higher. And that's where the goal comes from, is he basically is too far forward. He gets bypassed by the little flick and away we go. But there were, I'm with you, there were definitely just moments in this one where it felt like a quick adjustment here, a quick player move there, and most of the things are kind of sorted. Not trying to say I know more than Pep, because I certainly don't, but I'm with you that a lot of this didn't make sense for Manchester City. And contrasting that with Spurs, I think we did see a lot of Nuno getting this team together, playing in a very like hard-nosed, hard-fought way. Japhet Tanganga had an immense game, and yeah, I think if you're a Spurs fan, you're feeling optimistic.
You definitely are, but just to touch on Man City one more time, Pep was full of excuses after the game. He was talking about the Euros, he was talking about COVID, all these things that have affected many other teams, Tottenham included. This was a game where Walker and Stones didn't start. We had Nathan Ake in the back again, who's probably quite low on confidence given the Community Shield output that he had. It seemed like City just weren't quite the races. Lots of, you know, they were getting off some shots from the edge of the box, and they're allowing a lot of shots from the edge of the box as well, I should say, as well. But like, Gundogan, I'd counted a few uncharacteristic sloppy passes from him. And as we've mentioned here, Fernandinho was made to look all of his 36 years for long periods here. But what I'll ask is, didn't we have this same feeling at the start of last season? Wasn't it sort of five to 10 games before Man City showed up?
Yeah, that's right. And really, I was looking back through how Manchester City have started Premier League seasons under Guardiola. And actually, the only really good start that they had was in his first season when they didn't win the Premier League title and actually fell away and finished fourth, I think, or third or fourth that season. So, yes, it's certainly a feature of their play under Guardiola that they do start slowly. I have to say, though, given that there hasn't really been much upheaval, you know, Grealish is the only player who's come into that team, I still think it's reasonable to expect more of them. I mean, you look at the players that they had on the pitch. Yes, sure, they, you know, some of those players maybe aren't ready after the Euros, have had a little bit extra time off, but City have the most stacked squad in the Premier League. Their squad is a joke. I think only maybe PSG's squad is stronger, and even then I would argue it's their starting lineup that's stronger. I think City have the strongest depth options in all of football. So I think it's reasonable to expect more of them, but it does really feel like when those teams came out, I looked at City and I saw a team that's waiting for Harry Kane to be signed. And then I looked at Spurs, and even though things panned out slightly better for them, I also saw a team that is waiting for Harry Kane to be sold. So it just feels like they both teams, for their own sake. And actually, I think this result and performance probably made it more likely that Kane will go, because City will spend the money given that their season hasn't started that well. And I think this performance and result for Spurs will show to them that they can still be a successful team without Harry Kane. So I just think this, again, no inside information, I just think this result probably increases the likelihood that deal will get done.
Yeah, Graham, I'm totally with you. And even watching the way that front three for Spurs sort of stuck together but interchanged, and sometimes Son was central, sometimes he was on the left, sometimes he popped up on the right, sometimes Lucas Moura was central, and there was just so much fluidity to the way they played and mobility, and that's not a thing I think of when I think of Harry Kane. Certainly he has a lot of skill set, like a lot of strengths that he could bring to both Man City and Spurs, but I didn't see a ton of him in this lineup for Spurs. Now, he does feel more like a Raul Jimenez type of player, that if he were fit, I'm sure Nuno would change things and play off of him and find ways to combine with him. But I agree, Graham, that it felt to me like one team was really missing Harry Kane, and it was not the team that currently employs and pays him. It was the team that had runners trying to pull people out of position and trying to stretch the line. But I saw on multiple occasions, Torres and Sterling would make the same run to the same space, or Torres and Mahrez, or Grealish and Sterling, and there wasn't that sort of dedicated focal point of the attack. You think about the way Dortmund attack through Erling Haaland, we'll talk about them later, but there's just that ruthlessness, there's the awareness of where he needs to be, what run he needs to make, there's the demand to have the ball, and then he can run the plays, and I think City were just missing a little bit of that sort of goal-scoring nous, I believe is what you Brits would call it, and I think that did make a big difference in this game.
Taylor, What do you think we learned about Nuno Ball, as Graham has dubbed it here? We had a 4-3-3 here. Do you think we're going to see a back three soon? I mean, players like Tanganga, who was superb in this game, could probably slot into that kind of system quite nicely. There was fears that Nuno Ball might be a bit similar to Mourinho Ball in a Tottenham context, but you know, there wasn't too much negativity on show here. It was quite fast and fluid going forward. Lots of hard work being done, some good decision-making. What did you make of it?
I mean, I thought it was great, and I think it was way better than I thought it was going to be. This weekend was pretty eye-opening for me because I had worries about Spurs and how they were going to adjust. I thought they would fall off pretty precipitously, and I don't think that as much. I thought the same of Barcelona. What are they going to do with no Lionel Messi? They're in a lot of trouble. They go out and win. Everton, I was sure we're going to have a rough season. They may well still. Obviously, it's only 1 week, but they get the win. And then Arsenal lost because we're going to be right about some things. We're not going to get everything wrong. So we can feel comfortable with that one. Lots of shots at Arsenal in this one. But yeah, I think overall, we saw a lot of positivity, and not just in the result, but in the way that there was fight across the board. There was a physicality and a willingness to get stuck in. And again, Tanganga is central to that, even if he was at right back, heyo. Just that, like, there were a lot of the professional fouls, but then some clean wins, and he himself started drawing fouls as the game went on. And I think it wasn't the most, like, heralded Spurs team. It's Eric Dier and Sanchez as your two center backs. If ever there were a time when I thought they would go with a back three, it was this one. Instead, they go with more of a 4-2-3-1, but Dele Alli doing an attacking role and dropping in and being the kind of hard-nosed midfielder that I did not remember that he could be, but certainly he can. And I think there were a lot of things to be excited about if you're a Tottenham fan. And honestly, I think probably things to be excited about if you're a City fan for the reasons that you all have already spotlighted, which is they're still going to sign somebody. I'm guessing it's Harry Kane. I tweeted it doesn't seem like it would be the worst idea to maybe just see how much Karim Benzema would cost from Real Madrid right now. But I think if you can't do that, they will bring in somebody. But I think there is plenty of reason to be optimistic if you're a City fan as well. But overall, a stronger weekend between the two for Spurs.
Just when you talk about, Taylor, the positivity of Spurs in this game, there was definitely a trend across the Premier League. I felt there was a trend anyway of home teams attack. I mean, as Ryan referenced at the top of the show, there wasn't a draw in the Premier League.
Good call.
I'm looking at the results, and it just felt, with crowds back at these games, it felt like there was a real onus on every home team to attack. Now, obviously, not every game was a home win. There were three away wins, but of those three away wins, two of the home teams took the lead. So that was Burnley and Newcastle. So that still showed that they were coming out and attacking right from the off, the exception being Norwich, who were up against Liverpool. So that's quite a difficult one for them. I definitely felt that as a trend across the league this weekend with fans back in the stands.
I think we saw the opposite of that as well when we resumed play after COVID, that home teams started dropping results and conceding more at home and then getting results on the road. And there was some speculation that was because they were used to that sort of 12th man, that sort of pick up when you need it. When you don't have it, you don't have that motivation to fight back. It just becomes that much harder. So yeah, with fans back, I'm not surprised to see those home teams going for it a bit more, celebrating a bit more, and just there being a little bit more positivity for most of the home teams.
So we've learned that Tottenham are quite good. We've learned that Man City still can't win at this particular stadium. Tottenham winning this one 1-0. We'll be back after this break with some news about Man United against Leeds.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep. You heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/credit card.
Total Soccer Show, we are back. Manchester United 5, Leeds 1. Taylor Rockwell, the dream start for your team here. The dream start for Paul Pogba. 4 assists, a Man United Premier League record for him. Last time, I believe, in the corresponding fixture last season, this one was 6-2. This one felt a bit more comprehensive, though, did it not, Taylor?
It did, and we're stopping the season now, right? Manchester United champions, we're good to go. Sorry to Leeds, who are now getting relegated as a result. But yeah, I think we good to call this season over? Season one champions? Yeah.
It was a tight title race with Brentford, but it just got over the line on goal difference.
Yeah. Oh man, this was exciting. And I tweeted before, I think the night before, that I'm like, I don't know if it's the Varane signing or Sancho. I think it was the hype video, the preseason hype video that they put out, but I was really back in. I was really excited in a way that I haven't been to watch Manchester United play in a while. And maybe it's just like familiarity. Maybe it's Ole Gunnar Solskjaer still being there and I'm just making my peace with it. But it was fun to watch this team. And I think they rewarded those home fans with a fun performance. And as you said, the four assists from Paul Pogba stand out, the hat trick for Bruno Fernandes, but even that great finish from Mason Greenwood to pull the lead back. That was just so many times I've been at games, season openers. I always go back to DC United Colorado, where DC get a penalty. They miss the penalty, Colorado win, and that sets the stage for DC to have a pretty mediocre season, which is kind of par for the course for them. But I always wonder, like, what would have happened if they'd scored that penalty? What happens when you have that moment in the opening game or on your debut and you take it and you score? And what is that, like, tone does that set? And Mason Greenwood, there's another reality in which he pings that off the post and it's no goal. And there's still questions about where does he fit in and should it be Cavani and what's the formation? And I think that they get the result in the way they do. It probably calms some nerves, not that there were that many jangled nerves around Old Trafford, but I think it also just is a reminder that there is depth there and there is a quality to this team that some, myself included, maybe tend to forget.
Yeah, my Manchester United supporting father-in-law raves about Mason Greenwood, how he's, you know, the best player at Man United for a long time. And Ole Gunnar Solskjaer does the same thing, says he's the best finisher at the club as well. He certainly had a good time, Graham, in this one. Can you sort of summarise or speculate as to what the positioning situation was with him and Bruno? Because it's at times it seemed like they were both doing a false nine. They both seemed to have a lot of freedom to move around in this one. They both dropped deep when needed, but both very impressive as well.
Yeah, and I think you're right to be, I wouldn't say confused, because I think that was the intention, to have a lot of fluidity, a lot of interchangeability. But Carl Anka at The Athletic wrote a good piece about this over the weekend. I think he's been tweeting about this for quite some time as well, how Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, he looks to the 2007-2008 Manchester United team, the front line of Rooney, Tevez and Ronaldo, and how they, not one of them seemed to be an orthodox centre forward, but just having them moving all over the place made them so difficult to track and having that fluidity. And now I'm not saying that Man United have that level yet, but you can definitely see that the way Solskjaer is developing Greenwood is really interesting. And to reference Carl again, he talked about how Solskjaer is adding different layers to Greenwood's game to build him up to be just a complete forward and to avoid calling him a centre forward, because he's more than that. You know, he was drifting out to the right, he was making runs through the middle. There was one moment in this first half where Greenwood drops really deep and he beats a man with a little bit of a dribble, a little bit of skill. I think it's actually for the Paul Pogba chance that he should score before that happens. He then scores the goal from the left side, and I think he really set the tone for this Manchester United performance. I know Pogba was the guy kind of pulling the strings from deep, but it was Greenwood who I looked to as, that's what Solskjaer wants from this Manchester United attack. And Taylor, you might remember a game all the way back in 2006, I think it was, because it was before Manchester United won the first title with that front line. And it was a home game against Bolton, and it was the first game of the season, and they won 5-1.
Yep.
And after a couple seasons of building, people will forget, this was still with Ferguson, after a couple seasons of building, Man United had been kind of a little bit out in the wilderness a little bit, but they had this young forward line. And that 5-1 game against Bolton was a little bit of a ta-da moment where Ferguson kind of lifted the curtain up and we saw what this team was all about. Now, there's a long way to go, and I'm not saying Manchester United are definitely going to win the title. I'm not really comparing it to that team, but this felt like a little bit of a ta-da moment for Solskjaer, where I was in no doubt that Manchester United were going to not just win this game, but comprehensively win this game. It just felt like there was something in the air. And I'm really positive about this Man United team. I think they're going to have a good season again. Doesn't mean that I think they're going to win the title, but I thought this was a really impressive win for them. If there was one negative, I think we still got a sign of where their one glaring weakness is, which the Luke Ayling goal was an absolute stunner. Yeah. but it comes from a lack of positional awareness from Fred and Pogba. They allowed him far too much space, and that's the one position I think I've said previously. If Man United get us a midfield anchor, I think they're almost the complete team. And even in this victory, there was a sign of that.
And I think to continue the comparison that Carl was going with, like I think that 06-07 team doesn't yet have Carlos Tevez. I think he's added at the end of that season. And I remember then thinking like that they had just won the Premier League title. Like that doesn't seem fair. And then they go on to win the Champions League. Not saying that's going to happen here, but I think there's another parallel with adding an attacker like Jadon Sancho, who maybe does have some similarities to Carlos Tevez when being added to that Man United team. And you can sort of see how they're bringing in key attacking components to a team that has at least some level of consistency about them because they've kept Ole around longer than they've kept other managers. So I think there's an argument there. There's still certainly, some gaps to be filled and some things to be figured out. Announcing Rafael Varane before the game is probably not the worst way to bring about even more confidence. So I think overall there's probably still some issues and it's not quite as rock solid of a team as that 07-08 team was. But I think overall, a very positive sign for Man United fans.
And Fred got the fifth goal. The commentator said words to the effect of, Fred's getting involved now. As if it was the ultimate indignity for Leeds United, which it may well have been. You mentioned the positioning for the ailing goal there, Graham. But does this give any vindication for the McFred partnership this game, though? It did seem like they did a really good job of screening the defence. They were winning a lot of ball, winning a lot of balls, giving a lot of cover, and Maguire and Lindelof behind them. By the way, when you've got two players there who are really capable of putting a 40, 50-yard pass forward like straight down the lines, that's a really good asset as well. But the McFred partnership, I thought, maybe got some reprieve in this game.
Yeah, and it's not that I don't think Solskjaer he needs to play that partnership at the moment because it's obviously a tactical necessity, a structural necessity that he needs to have the protection. It's just that I feel that role should probably be one player. And Man United don't have that one player at the moment. So it's not that I don't look at that team when Solskjaer picks that side and go, oh, Fred and McTominay are playing together again. I think they have to, particularly as you referenced there, Ryan, particularly in a game like this where you need to provide a little bit more protection to the back four. It's just if they go out and get, I mean, the example everyone uses, obviously, N'Golo Kante, but finding someone like him might be difficult. But if someone in that mould, I think you take those two players and you put them into one, and then all of a sudden you have an extra place in your team to have maybe a more attack-minded player or even just a number eight in there. That's the one weakness in this Man United team. But I thought it was a pretty, even someone like Dan James, I mean, obviously Dan James starts this match and you think he is maybe the odd one out in this team, but he has a tactical purpose against Leeds. He always plays well against Leeds and against Chelsea, where you want to push those teams back. You know, those teams have a lot of a lot of ability in terms of a high press and so on. And James actually think does that well against City as well. So even he has a tactical purpose, and that's why I look. I'm not saying Solskjaer is Pep Guardiola on Pep's level or on Klopp's level, but He's not a Norwegian PE teacher, as people like to say. He does have a base level of tactics, and I think James' inclusion and the fact he's still sticking with Fred and McTominay shows that.
I think there is a pretty strong comparison, at least in my mind, between the England team we watched this summer and this Manchester United team. And I would say like the Declan Rice, Calvin Phillips partnership is similar to the McFred partnership in that you have that sort of those two players who can sit in front of the back line, who can screen, and then you can rely on your four very attacking creative players to try to create something. The problem becomes when you're playing a team that is sitting deeper and is trying to frustrate. And Leeds are Leeds. They're going to high press. They're going to be very high intensity. They're also going to try to man mark on occasion. And I think that's a big reason why we saw Bruno moving around, was trying to pull Koke out of position. But what ends up happening is you then get stretched, you then get opened up, and Man United can counter through there. When you're playing a more bunkered team, you don't need those two holding midfielders. And to Graham's point, I think that's where you run into the same old obstacles. So in some ways, Leeds are probably the ideal opponent to open up for if you're Manchester United, this particular Manchester United. But when you do have to play Burnley, for example, that's where I think the McTominay-Fred frustration reappears, unless they're able to kind of just rely on that front four. But I think going against a bunker team with McTominay, Fred, and even Daniel James, who I don't think of as being a particularly technical player, I think he's very good on the break and can attack open space. I think that's where we'll have to see how much this team has truly evolved.
And a note on Leeds, why did they keep getting caught out in this game, particularly in the second half, Graham? Was it maybe Cock was at fault a few times, not quite tight enough with his man? That sounds really rude. He wasn't maybe leaving space to exploit, I should say. It seemed like at times they're a bit too open against a team of the quality of Man United. There's one other thing as well, by the way, and Bolton Wanderers in the game I watched were doing this. Maybe one of you can explain this to me. The goal kicks where you have two defenders in the box beside you. What is the intended purpose of that? Because is it to draw players in? Because quite often, you know, those players the ball won't be passed sideways to one of those defenders. It'll be a chance to pull players in and then boot the ball downfield into space, I presume is what the intention is. But it didn't quite work because I think United's first goal came directly from them trying that. So yeah. Any ideas about what that's about and what its intention is, Graham?
I have to say that was one of the things maybe I didn't notice. I'm not saying it didn't happen, but yeah, I think the intention would surely be to draw players out so that you can then bypass that front line, that first line, and then knock the ball into midfield, and all of a sudden you're getting turned and you're exposing that soft underbelly of Manchester United that we've just spoken about with Fred McTominay and that back four without Raphael Varane integrated yet. So yeah, that was maybe the intention. It didn't really work. I mean, Leeds, this is a common trend for Leeds at Old Trafford now. 11 goals they've conceded in the two games they've played there and after getting promoted back to the Premier League. And I think this was actually worse than last season. Primarily, I don't want to pick on the guy because it's actually not his best position, but you mentioned the Robin Koch playing in the Calvin Phillips role. And I think in his absence, this was an illustration of just how good and important Calvin Phillips is to this Leeds United team, not just in terms of the protection he offers. I think that is often highlighted as his best quality for Leeds, but actually in terms of how he recycles the ball and actually starts moves for Leeds, I think they were really lacking in that respect. And while they did create a few chances, there was a Rafinha chance late on, which was particularly painful for me, given that I had spent a lot of time and effort trying to get him into my fantasy team because I think he's going to have a good season. There wasn't the customary number of Leeds chances. The game last season was 6-2, wasn't it?
Yes.
And really, it could have been 6-6 that game. Leeds had a number of chances, and that wasn't really the case. I felt 5-1 was a more accurate reflection of how this game went. So they will get better, Leeds. Calvin Phillips will come back into the side. I think that will make a big difference, and they'll sharpen up a little bit. And I wouldn't be too worried if I was Leeds, to be honest.
Yeah, Everton and Burnley up next for Leeds. Maybe a chance to recoup some points at this early stage of the season as well. One thing to note about this game, by the way, it is a rivalry game. It's a big sort of traditional rivalry, Man United and Leeds. And there was an ugly side to this game. There was lots of fighting in the streets of Manchester beforehand. And you may have seen on social media footage of Leeds fans chanting Sancho and Rashford, "You've let the country down." In reference to the Euro 2020 and their participation in the penalty shootout. No, Leeds fans, you've let your country down. You've let your country down, singing like that, frankly. Disgusting stuff. We don't need to see anything like that. But a good result for Man United all the same, and back to the drawing board for Leeds. Why don't we park the Premier League there, gents? Taylor, do you fancy going to Catalonia with me? Barcelona against Real Sociedad. It's a new era for Barcelona, a new era for the Liga, particularly in the US. Bit strange having the game on ABC. No Ray Hudson, no Phil Shane. It was Ian Dark and Macca we had on the call there, like the ESPN Premier League olden days, if you will, the olden days of what, 2010. But this is really good for the league, I think, being on ABC, a big massive new reach for the league, if any, particularly when it's on big boy ABC as it was. And a good result. And this was for Barcelona as well, Taylor. This one finishing 4-2 to the Catalans. They could use some good results at the moment, as we're learning they're 1.3 billion euros in debt. We're learning that they paid a scout in South America 8 million euros, and they are lamenting these kind of financial decisions.
Is that Neymar's dad?
Possibly. I feel like you are joking, but like maybe? Like that does feel like a distinct possibility.
A very definite distinct possibility. And there was the forgiveness of the debt to Neymar of 16 million euros or something. Or the
Talking about it. They're going to figure it out. Don't worry about it, Ryan. Don't ask too many questions. I did feel like there was, to go back to it for a moment, like the Gerard Piqué taking a pay cut. I know that makes him like very much even more beloved to Barca fans, and he's willing to make a sacrifice, and that's good of him. There's a part of me that really actively hates that, though, because like this is like to some extent on a very basic level, I know he is a very well compensated player and he makes more than most people will make in their lifetime, like, and probably makes that in a year. But there is still an idea that like this is, to me, on some level, it's a hotel that's overspent and has way too many amenities and they spent way too much for them, asking all of their staff to take a pay cut so that they can continue to operate. And there's an element of the business made a lot of mistakes and now it's the individuals who have to make up for them. Again, very well compensated millionaires, but there's just an idea of the club celebrating that, like, yeah, we didn't operate anything the way we're supposed to, and now the players have to take pay cuts, and even then there's the debate about, like, well, why didn't Messi take more, and what could they have done? And it's just, I don't know. It's good of him, it's very noble of him, but simultaneously, it frustrates me that that's a thing that we have to celebrate the way that I think people are.
Barcelona bought too many of those little shampoo bottles.
Yeah!
It's way too many of those.
Kept way too many ropes.
Yeah, too many slippers. Yeah, I mean, I get what you mean. Taylor, completely. It shouldn't be on PK to take that pay cut when it's a giant. I know we all like to think romantically of football clubs, particularly Barcelona, but let's be honest, you know, a corporation, a company, a business that has overspent and overreached. But if I'm to be slightly cynical on the PK pay cut, that is an investment in his next job, shall we say. And I know I said Presidente there, all, kind of tongue-in-cheek, but I'm also being entirely serious. Gerard Piqué, I think it's nailed on, at some point in the future will be Barcelona president. And this will do his campaign a lot of good. If it needed, you know, it was already a pretty strong campaign, but this will just get it over the line, I think. That job's in the bag for him.
The folks upstairs are pouring praise on him at the moment as well, Graham. So certainly they're helping his case to one day replace them. Quite a bit of poetry in the fact that Gerard Piqué got the first goal, the assist from the free kick from Memphis Depay, the player who was allowed to be registered after he took the pay cut as well. One thing that did bother me about this game, the half and half shorts that Barca are wearing. I know we don't feel good about half and half shirts, but we had the asymmetric stripes on the shirts combined with half and half shorts of different colours. Not into it, Graham. How do you feel as our resident kit expert?
No, it's. I totally agree. It's the shorts. The shirt is bad also, but you could at least say, well, they're trying. And then you get to the shorts and you go, oh, you're trying way too hard. This is a step too far.
Indeed.
That aside, I gotta say, like, I have come around to the idea that this could be a very big season for Barcelona. Not just because, like, oh, there's no Messi, what's going to happen? But watching this game, obviously they get this result, but I think it had not really occurred to me how big a chip on the shoulder a lot of these players are going to have.
Yeah.
And it's a Messi-sized chip, because all, I just picture myself in a team where our most important talismanic player has left, and left very publicly. And the response has been like, well, that's it for Barcelona. Like, it is just obituaries about this club and how poorly they've been run, the exodus of players and how they're and if you are one of the players still in that squad, you hear all that, you read all that. And I feel like this performance showed that, like, Martin Braithwaite can do things. And no, he's not Lionel Messi. He's not of that caliber. But this Barcelona team, Ian Dark kept saying it throughout the broadcast, like, they're still very good. They've still had a lot of money spent on them. And I think there's an argument that this team has that extra level of motivation and intensity because no one believes in them. Everyone has written them off, and they are very much succeeding in spite of the other people involved at this club. And I also think there's, like, would be very interesting if Ronald Koeman basically recognized, like, there are other people out there who want this job. There are maybe other people out there who the people in power would like to have my job. So I'm just going to score some goals. And I think that there's an idea with this team that, like, we're going to win every game 4-3. We're going to win every game 5-3 or 5-2. And there's, like, a Mike D'Antoni offense style to this. Of, like, we're not going to play any defense. We're just going to outscore you 154 to 121 or something like that. And I don't think that's the worst idea, to just let Barcelona loose and let them score a bunch of goals. And if they lose some games 5-4 or 4-3, whatever it is, like, if you're a manager, you can always come back to, like, yeah, we just need better defenders and we just got to freshen up the defense and we'll be fine. But if you're scoring a bunch of goals and entertaining people, I think that's a good way to engender goodwill. So I think there is a lot more positivity to this team than I think I would have expected heading into this game.
Yeah, there was also an interesting, sorry, Ryan, there was also an interesting dynamic in the stadium as well, where Messi's name was chanted after 10 minutes, the significance of that being obvious, and the stadium kind of joined in, and there was a chance of Messi and so on. Then it happened again in 10 minutes into the second half from a section of the supporters, and they were drowned out by whistles and jeers, which was almost, that was a message. At that point, Barcelona were they 2-0 up at that stage? They were 3-0.
Yeah,
no, they were 2-0
so.
Up, yeah. They were 2-0 up at that stage and playing really well. And that to me was already, that was much quicker than I expected. Acknowledgement
Agreed.
From the Barcelona fans of, hold on a minute here, there's still good players at this club. We can still win games and we're still FC Barcelona. You know, let's move on already. And that has happened a lot quicker than I expected, you know, the second half of the first game without Messi. So I think that's quite significant. They may have, I'm not saying moved on entirely, but that process has started.
And Sid Lowe noting on Twitter that the 20-odd thousand people in the Camp Nou were louder, he said, than some often times when it's been full as well. So a half-decent atmosphere in there too. Graham Brathwaite had a good game here, didn't he? 2 goals and an assist. I think that characterises a good game. Do you buy into the narrative that he's improving, or has he already been this good? He's always been a hard worker, and he can always look pretty classy on his day, but maybe he's got a bit more breathing room.
Oh yeah, he certainly has more breathing room now, and I have always been a bit of a fan of Martin Brathwaite. I said that during the Euros. I think he gets a lot of harsh criticism, particularly from English football fans, because he wasn't very good for Middlesbrough about 10 years ago. He's changed a bit since then and got a bit better since then. Players are allowed to do that. I don't expect him to have, you know, he scored 2 goals and got an assist in this game. He's not going to do that every game. He's not going to be the new Messi, but he does give them something a little bit different, particularly if Memphis Depay is going to be their new attacking hub, which was very much obvious in this game. I mean, he loves playing for Barcelona. You can see that already. Memphis Depay was born to play for FC Barcelona.
The flick in the first minute. Come on.
It wasn't just the flicks and tricks either. There was a final product to his play. He influenced so much, and he's wanted this for so long. You know, he's waited 2 years to play for Barcelona, certainly since last summer when it looked like Koeman was going to get him. So he's going to be kind of the attacking hub of that team, and that means there's going to be space for Brathwaite to kind of break him behind. He gives him a bit more verticality, and also he bursts into the box and like no other player they've got. You know, the other players that do that are maybe who? Jordi Alba and Sergino Dest, who are the fullbacks. So I like Brathwaite as an option. He might not play every game. I think Ansu Fati, once he comes back from injury, that is probably his place. I think that front three of Fati, Depay and Griezmann will probably be first choice, but he's a good option, and there's a lot of talk of Brathwaite maybe being sold on at the moment. I know Barcelona are desperate for cash, and if it comes down to that, then fair enough, they might just have to take the money. But if it's about building a squad, I would be holding on to him.
I got to say, I agree with you on Brathwaite, and I want to talk about Memphis for a moment, because if there was one person who is no longer with us who loved what they saw from Memphis Depay, it is Johan Cruyff. And this is a very, like, pushing up my glasses soccer nerd thing. But going back to Johan Cruyff becoming a manager and taking over Barcelona and creating basically this Barcelona team that became what we know Barcelona to be today, this very exciting attacking team that will spend money, but at least then somewhat responsibly. But his major rival at that time was Louis van Gaal, who was a bit more, you have to do it this way, you have to take these two touches, you must play this way. It was much more structured, much more detail-oriented. And Memphis goes to Man United, does not have success, does not have anything approximating the success I think that was expected, and I do think a lot of that is Louis van Gaal and having a much more measured, you must play this way, it must be done according to my understanding and my views on the game, and it doesn't work out. And for him to go to Barcelona, the club of Johan Cruyff, and just shine the way he did and bring that exuberance, it was just like the thesis statement in the way you're supposed to play if you're a Johan Cruyff fanatic or disciple, and I do love Johan Cruyff, so this one made me really happy. And just this team as a whole, I thought the way they played was really interesting, with Sergio Busquets essentially being a left center back. It lets Frankie de Jong be in a position that I think is much more comfortable for him. Mildly annoyed that Pedri continues to remind me what it's like to be young, where you can just play 400 games in a month and then play another one, because why not? But he was excellent, and I think there's just a lot of quality that hasn't maybe been appreciated or not fully appreciated by Barcelona that is now there and will thrive. And that doesn't mean they're going to be the best team in Spain, or that doesn't mean this is going to be a team that wins a lot of silverware, but I think it's going to be a competitive team that fights in a way that maybe I wasn't expecting.
And how would Johan Cruyff feel about that last 10 minutes, Taylor, where they almost brought it back to 3-3, basically? Othabal with that brilliant free kick to make it 3-2, yeah. And it was only Lloris getting caught out on the break that made it 4-2.
He would have smoked.
Well.
Cruyff would have smoked. that's what he would have made it. He would have started smoking on the sidelines, almost certainly.
You would have smoked in every sense of the word, I would imagine, Tay-Tay. All right. Barcelona 4, Real Sociedad 2, this one was. Will Barcelona still be giving positive vibes next week? Tune in to find out. Who knows? We'll be back after these short messages with some Bundesliga.
This episode is supported by Season 3 of FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher division. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenges and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
Today's episode is brought to you by Shopify. On the Total Soccer Show, we often talk about the importance of a manager who can clearly and effectively communicate their tactics, and then a squad of players capable of executing that approach, but also adding some individual flair along the way. And that's the same relationship you're getting with Shopify. You tell them how you want things to work or what you need to get done, and they execute the game plan, sometimes even better than you could have expected, with Shopify Magic, their AI-powered all-star. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage to the first real store stage, all the way to the did we just hit over a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. From what I've heard from family members who use Shopify for their online store, which has evolved into an amazing brick-and-mortar location, Shopify has helped with that growth, and with every step along the way, they've made it easier to process and track orders, run the business day-to-day, and help with long-term growth as well. So whether you're auctioning autographed jerseys or selling custom stadium prints, both of which are awesome, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% compared to other leading commerce platforms. And you can sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, the aforementioned AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States and is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, their extensive help resources are there to support your success every step of the way, because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial at shopify.com/TSS. That's all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/TSS now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. One more time, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/TSS.
Total Soccer Show, we are back. Let's go to the Westfalenstadion. Borussia Dortmund took on Eintracht Frankfurt and got a 5-2 win on Saturday. This comes after Bayern Munich opened the season with a 1-1 draw against Gladbach on Friday night. Graham, this is Marco Rose's Dortmund. Erling Haaland scoring twice here and set up another three goals. Quite an afternoon for the Norwegian as they steamrolled past Frankfurt here. Gio Reyna on the score sheet as well. With his compatriot Christian Pulisic this weekend. Wonderful stuff. Graham, the biggest takeaway from me here was from the television angle, the amount of beer that was thrown each time Dortmund scored. I know beer is cheaper in German stadiums, but it seemed like there was one guy in front of the camera who was always throwing his beer. Do you think he just got a beer, threw it, oh, they're going to score again, got to go get another one?
Yeah. Seven goals in this game. I can't imagine that he actually drank much beer, if that was the case. His whole game was just spent running back and forward from the bar.
It feels like when you do like the thing, this will resonate for both of you, I'm guessing. Like a thing that makes your small child laugh, and then they just demand that you keep doing it, and you're like, yeah. I wish I hadn't started this. It's great that they're enjoying it, but simultaneously, I have to go buy another however many euro beer, because, and now everyone's expecting me to dump it out again. I loved that, and I loved the commentary team getting increasingly concerned about how much that individual was spending.
Exactly so, yeah, exactly. And how drenched the people around him were getting as well. Right? They couldn't have been that happy about it.
No.
But Graham, this Marco Rose team, what did we learn about them? They were in sort of a 4-2-3-1 here, looked very, very quick in transition, but also sloppy goals conceded and sloppy set pieces conceded. So business as usual?
Yeah, there were some signs of progress, and we definitely learned more about how Marco Rosa is going to use this Dortmund squad. There were also some signs, as you referenced there, Ryan, of some of the problems that Dortmund had last season still being a problem this season. Obviously, it's only day one in the Bundesliga, so Rosa still has some time to work on those. But I think he does deserve a lot of credit for how he has shifted this Dortmund team already. Obviously, one of the big talking points, arguably the biggest talking point for Dortmund this season, at least on the pitch, obviously they've got a new manager as well, but Jadon Sancho is no longer there, stating the obvious. So how are they going to adapt without him? And I think one of the things we learned from this game was that wingers might not be as key a part of Dortmund's play as it was previously. So there isn't really a Jadon Sancho replacement. They are much more centralised, that Reina, Haaland, Thorgan Hazard, who he can play as a wide man, but I thought he was playing a bit more central here. And then Marco Reusser, who, by the way, I'm delighted to see him. I'm really excited about his continued revival. He looked really fresh, particularly in the first half. He was doing a lot to press high up the pitch, lots of energy, nice flicks, good decision making. I'm really excited for his kind of career renaissance and how important he could be to this Marco Rosa team. But yeah, I think Rosa is getting the best out of Dortmund's strengths early on, which is essentially in the attack. At the back, there are a few more questions. Axel Witsel played as one of the centre backs, which I will admit I hadn't seen much of Dortmund in pre-season, so that was a little bit of a surprise to me. I've since read that had been experimented with before, but that was a surprise to me. He was played alongside Manuel Akanji, but that did allow them to control possession. I think that was the idea. You know, Witsel is much more of a ball player, so having him in central defence allowed him to control the ball. Nobody played more passes than those two players. And then Dahoud and Bellingham in the middle, very dynamic through Bellingham, as you would come to expect. And then a good level of control through Dahoud. And then you have Erling Haaland doing Erling Haaland things. I mean, his record for Dortmund is incredible. 61 games he's played for the club, and he averages a goal or an assist every 62 minutes. Wow. That is something else.
That's quite a lot, isn't it, when you think about it?
Yep.
Taylor, Erling Haaland looked, and I use the cliche, literally unplayable at times here. It's just like he couldn't get near him. He was winning everything. He was stealing balls left, right, and centre. He was, you know, even his goal celebrations, they seemed to go up a level. He was mounting Marco Reus on the floor after the first goal, it appeared. But I ask, like, if Manchester City are so hot in pursuit of someone like Harry Kane, why are they not going a little harder after someone like Erling Haaland?
I don't know, is the answer.
Because they're dumb.
I mean, sure, let's go with that. I mean, I think there is probably the price tag. I understand that there's a hesitation from Haaland to maybe commit to playing in the Premier League. Obviously, his father had a rough go, courtesy of Roy Keane playing in the Premier League.
His dad literally played for that team. He could, you know, and he was born in Manchester. Why wouldn't he go back?
Then, I mean, it's his dad, right, who gets his knee broken by Roy Keane. Like, there's I think, an element of maybe the physicality of the Premier League is a question mark for him. But that aside, maybe it's the price tag, and if Jadon Sancho costs what he cost, Erling Haaland is probably going to cost double. But he seems, so my point earlier about how, like, City were missing a forward who just wanted the ball, knew where he needed to be, knew what the runs needed to be. I mean, that was Erling Haaland throughout this game, just like picking up the ball and nobody, even Gio Reyna, who constantly was demanding the ball and wanted the ball and wanted the ball. As soon as Haaland is near him, it's like, nope, it's yours. I know I'm not getting this one. On you go. And Ryan, to your point about Leeds and the way they were trying to take their goal kicks, I was going to say then, but it fits here that like, Dortmund did exactly that. It just works because they have Haaland to aim for, who can bring everything down and hold the ball up and run in behind. And he gives you so many different looks. I think Man City, like, the only thing I can argue is that they don't want to add him because they at least want it to be like a somewhat competitive stroll to the title. And they don't want to win it by like 40 points, which if you put him in that team, I don't know how they ever lose a game again.
Yes. Oh, you think you're doing it for competitive reasons then, Taylor?
Yes, they're being generous to us all, but
we all know that City are about the competitiveness of the Premier League,
and fairness and financial fairness and like just like the play that is financially fair. They're big on that.
Pep will take you to court. Be careful.
Allegedly, there we go. I'm covered. I will say the thing that I loved. I went back. I held a clock to this one. I had the stopwatch going for their first three goals, all three combined. From the time that they get the ball until the time it's in the back of the net, it takes 29.52 seconds for three goals to be scored. That is how rapid fire that counterattack is from Dortmund. And that is how important Erling Haaland is, because when he gets that ball, defenders collapse on him. It opens up space for other runners, and he himself can obviously score a goal or two. So I think he is just, it's just a reminder of how much of a physical specimen he is. If you put him and Paul Pogba on the same team, again, it's like when you didn't, those like old apocryphal stories of when you didn't have to dribble in basketball and just the giant guy would walk down the floor like holding the ball up as high as he could. That's what I picture. It's just Pogba and Haaland just holding off 12 people at once. You get an extra player on the field if you're playing against those two.
I don't think I've ever seen as strong a runner as Erling Haaland.
Right?
It's like watching the Iron Giant. Like run.
Erling Haaland is also voiced by Vin Diesel. Little known fact. It's a weird thing.
with Eintracht Frankfurt, excuse me, Graham. You know how quite often when Wayne Rooney started a season, it would take him sort of 5 or 6 games to sort of wake up and get fit. It felt like most Frankfurt players were in that same mindset for this game. They were quite sloppy here. I was looking up, they actually lost last weekend to SV Waldhof in the DFB Pokal first round. They're a dritte Bundesliga team, so they're in the third tier. They lost 2-0 to them, and then they've gone and got conceded 5 to Dortmund as well. It seems like they're not quite up to scratch at the moment. So maybe Dortmund were flattered a bit by that?
Slightly. I would agree that Frankfurt were very poor, and given the quality as a side, I did expect more from them. I think the positives in this game may have come towards the end of the match when they made some of their changes. The one that I was most excited about, although the end of the match, he came on at half-time, but it wasn't really until the latter stages that Jens-Petter Haug, I think is how you pronounce that, he was at AC Milan last season. Slightly surprised that AC Milan have let him go, because I thought he looked like a very interesting, exciting prospect. So I wouldn't be surprised if he becomes a bit of a key player for them very quickly. I like the way he is, I mentioned previously, an attacking hub about Memphis Depay. He has the potential to kind of be that sort of player for Frankfurt. And obviously they are transitioning slightly out into a new age with kind of new players, new managers, so on. And that's been the case for a couple of seasons, where every season Frankfurt seemed to lose, you know, a big player a few years ago. It was Luka Jovic, obviously, going to Real Madrid. So they have been in this situation before. What I'm trying to say is I don't think it's panic stations for them. They do tend to, as you mentioned, they're kind of start slowly. But, it was a bit poor for them. I'm looking at some of their match ratings, and there's nobody over 7. So that kind of tells you everything you need to know about how they played.
Yeah. He's Norwegian as well, isn't he? So yeah, a good day for Norwegian forwards at the Signal Iduna Park, if you will. So that was Dortmund against Eintracht 5-2 to Dortmund.
Can I just jump in to say, again, I think we need to end the season right now, because looking at the table, Stuttgart are top, an American has won the Bundesliga. Congratulations to Man United and VfB Stuttgart. Big seasons across the board for those two.
big season. And I once again emphasise that I'm glad that the Premier League season's stopping, because I'm financially benefiting from Manchester United being top of the Premier League when all is said and done, as I've mentioned on this show before. Probably another bit of Bundesliga news or German soccer news we should talk about. A sad weekend. Gerd Müller passed away this weekend as well. The legendary striker. He died at the age of 75 as well. You should certainly look into him. Check him out on YouTube if you don't know much about him as well. A very legendary figure for Bayern Munich, for many other for the German national team, and for German soccer fans. A sad day that was. One more game to talk about, gents. Let's take our attentions to Major League Soccer. We had the Timbers and the Sounders. Graham, a big scoreline here. 6-2 this one finishing to Seattle. Yeah. We had a rather good goal to celebrate in this one too.
Yes, absolutely. It's one of the goals of the season. I think they should just hand out the MLS goal of the season to this. Jimmy Madranda, a real Paul Scholes of a volley from a corner kick. It doesn't touch the ground. It's straight from the corner kick. Brilliant pass out to him, edge of the box, and he meets it first time, I think, with his left foot, and it smashes in off the underside of the bar. Goals are always better when they strike the underside of the bar and go in. And this is a goal that has bounced around social media all day. I have obviously got the European perspective, and it's been shared a lot over here. So I think when an MLS goal has that sort of reach, you know it's a good goal. And it wasn't the only good goal in this game, because the Raul Ruy Diaz free kick for 3-2 is an absolute missile as well into the top corner. I mean, this was a really, really fun game. I think that
You're a Timbers fan,
yes, but even for them, there was a good moment in the match. You know, at 2-2 after they fight back from 2-0 down. But I think this is the most I read. This is the most goals Seattle have ever scored against Portland in a single match in the MLS era. So yes, as you say, Taylor, there a fun one for Seattle, but by the time they got to full time, not so fun for the Timbers.
Yeah, Taylor, and the Timbers, I've read that second only to Toronto in terms of goals scored or goals conceded, are the Timbers, which is not where they would want to be. Certainly, I think still in playoff contention, but only just. But for Seattle, the way they're getting performances from the players you would expect, like Raul Ruy Diaz and Nico Lodero in there, but then for it to be Jimmy Madranda and Freddy Montero getting a goal, like, you need those contributions from those players that you bring in to have an impact, to kind of pick up the slack. If you have, say, Jordan Morris out for a big chunk of the season, then you can get those performances. And if those players basically raise their level or rise to the occasion, then you get a 6-2 win against your biggest rival, and I think things are happy for Seattle. And I just thought this was another one. I watched this one this morning that was just, it was a fun game. I think this weekend on the whole reminded us that this sport is really fun and really worth watching, even if you're not like a diehard fan. Just tuning in to watch a game, you never know what's going to happen, and you might get to see that goal from Madranda. Graham, refresh my memory. It goes off the other side of the post, which is always a positive. I know it does the then rocket down onto the ground just past the goal line, so you know it's gone in. Does it then have the courtesy to fly back up and hit the top of the netting as well? Because that really is the final point. Oh, that's wonderful.
It goes underside of the post, down off the turf, over the line, and then back up into the net again. Woo. Which is, it's almost the perfect goal.
Yeah.
Everything about it, it's so good. And that I think that's why it's had, I haven't actually checked, but I bet it's got about a million views on Twitter. It's really bouncing around.
Yeah, it's scientifically proven that if a goal like that does hit the woodwork, it is 10 times better. There's just science. You can't argue with it. Taylor, Seattle in the Western Conference at the moment are at 10-6-3. They're in second place behind Sporting Kansas. But do we just hand this thing to them again this year? What do you think?
Yeah, sure. I'm fine with that. I mean, I genuinely forgot what month it was for a moment. It's August. We got a long way to go. And I think, as is tradition, you have to have one team figure things out with like 7 games to go, sneak into the playoffs, and then make a deep run. So right now I feel like that's LAFC are poised to do something like that. So we'll have to wait.
Too late for Inter Miami?
Well, they need 4 more DPs, and then we'll see what they put together from there. Where are they? Are they? No, okay. They're 12th right now.
I just had the bottom. Yeah, they're moving on up.
Moving on up.
Maybe it's not too late then.
It is. Let's make no jokes. But no, I think Seattle they just do it, man. That's all there is to it. Yeah. They're just always in there. They're an ever-present fixture, and they back it up with performances like this.
I thought this was a really scary performance for the rest of MLS from Seattle. Obviously, they've had a little bit of a slump, but then they were a lot better in that League's Cup competition, which I have to say I've yet to fully grasp, but they were
correct.
A lot better in that game. but, you know, Nicholas Ladero coming on, and he's barely featured this season. Brian Schmetzer has been really keen to not throw him in. So he only comes in, I think, for the second half here. He's only played 10 minutes here and there as well in other games. And so the Sounders are a point off the top of the West when they've just got Ladero back, one of the best number 10s in the league. They're about to get their first choice goalkeeper back in Stephen Fry. Jordan Morris is working his way back from injury. And a player I wasn't actually familiar with until this game, but Benazet, I think is how you maybe pronounce that, has joined and has already found the back of the net in this game. And I just think they're a bit of a scary team. They've now scored 6 goals in the 99 minutes that Nicholas Ladero has spent on the field this season. So once he starts getting regular game time and actually starting matches, we might as well just wrap up this season. That is a distinct possibility with the way this Sounders team is going.
So Nico Ladero and Erling Haaland, equally impressive stats is what I'm hearing.
Yes, they're basically the same player is what I'm saying, yes.
Slightly different.
If you put Nico Ladero on Nico Ladero's shoulders, I think they're as tall as Erling Haaland. So yeah, that checks out.
Yeah.
All right, gents, I think that just about wraps up our weekend review. Unless, Taylor, you have anything more you'd like to share with the world?
No, just I think it's always fitting that whenever we go over an hour, it has to end with some sort of nonsense. And me trying to create a scenario in which Nico Ladero is stacked on top of himself while wearing a trench coat feels like a fit again to this show.
I feel like if the you know how NBA does like the dunk contest and all those sort of the 3-point contest and so on. If there was something like that in soccer, it should just be different players going on different players' shoulders and trying to knock over Erling Haaland. That's my proposal for that weekend.
The new skills challenge. I'm into it. Yeah. I'm into it. Who can withstand an Erling Haaland celebration at full 100% capacity? I don't know who could do that.
That's genius. We should call it the Vince Adultman competition in honor of Bojack and the two children in the raincoat who are.
I'm going for John McGinn. On as the base, I feel like I'm putting way too much thought into this. Luis Suarez on John McGinn would knock Erling Haaland over.
Can I have 3 Shaqiris? How about that? Cute.
That's a good shout as well.
That feels like some sort of prophecy. If you stack 3 power cubes on top of each other, I think that's the premise to Justice League. I might be wrong.
And on that bombshell, let's conclude our weekend review. Taylor Rockwell, a pleasure chatting with you as always. I look forward to continuing all through this season on a Monday, baby.
Right back at you, buddy.
And Graham Ruthven, what a pleasure for you to join us today as well. All the things I said to Taylor, but with your name in his place.
Thank you, Ryan. One weekend down, about a million to go. It never ends.
It never ends.
It's all enjoyable.
It is indeed. Such is the tapestry of life. Thank you, listener. We'll be back soon. Bye!